What is shopping for books like in Korea?
Well, I mean, there's amazing resources for books here, not just bookstores, but one of my favorite things is manhwa cafes where you like pay $1 per hour and it's just every volume of every manga and manhwa ever made. And I really, really wish I could go to them, but I don't read enough Korean.
It sounds like it would be just an amazing atmosphere.
They had beanbag chairs. Oh, nice.
I wish we had an equivalent in North America. Like, because I remember I lived in Japan for 3 years and the manga cafes were just so revolutionary to me. It's like, wait, so you hang out, you drink coffee, and you can just access any manga that's ever been printed, basically. And so you don't have to store a collection at home. You don't have to wait for the latest issue to come out and buy it. Like, you just go to the cafe and just at your leisure, like, I'm just gonna. Every weekend, I'm going to read a little bit more of Death Note. You know, like, that's
Yeah.
pretty cool.
Well,
You know what, Annie?
I almost don't want to tip my hand about this place, but they are starting to show up. So there's a place by Royal Oak that has an English language manga library, and they make omurice,
Nice.
they make nice bubble waffles. You can go and have a nice snack and read some manga for a while.
Oh,
Yeah,
man.
the thing I miss is when I first moved to Korea, like way back in 2002 when there were still video stores, half of every video store would be VHS and the other half would be comic books, and you could check out comic books for like 10 cents. And of course, video stores are gone, so that's gone too. But yeah, unfortunately, it's a lot harder to get English language books here, which we noticed when I was trying to find a book that we could read for the show. I'm like, I want to read something in print. There has to be something in this country.
Where did you have to go to get an English language book in Korea? I'm just curious.
Yeah, well, there is an amazing Busan English Library here in Busan where they have a really nice graphic novel collection. So you're not allowed to check them out, but if you make the trek out there, you can sit and read all day. I was just trying to find, I really want to talk about a banned book, and they didn't have any of the ones that I wanted to read. And then finally, I own this book that we're talking about today, but I lent it to someone and it kind of disappeared. And I finally got my copy back.
You may have noticed we have a guest on the Trade Readers today. Welcome, Ryan Estrada. You are the author of a banned book.
I am.
Maybe well, we have our episode that's about a different book, but maybe tell us really quick about Banned Book Club.
Yeah, so about 5 or 6 years ago, I was walking up a mountain with my wife, and she casually mentioned the time she was hunted down by the police for reading banned books and smuggling them across the country in 1980s Korea under a dictator. And I'm like, wait, you what? Huh? Wait. We've known each other for over a decade. We're married. How did I not know this? And we ended up making a graphic novel about it. We have a sequel that just came out called No Rules Tonight. Came out last month, and we got a third one coming out next year. And so it's been fun turning my wife, who had zero interest in comics, into an award-winning best-selling author and kind of bullying her into it. And so yeah, we made this book thinking like, oh well, it's an interesting bit of history people might be interested in. And then right after we started working on it, history started repeating itself, and this wave of book banning happened in the United States. And then our book became one of them because our book has been banned in 4 states at this point.
Oh,
Oh,
wow.
gosh, the irony.
Yeah. I mean, because I've read I read Banned Book Club just around the time
How
that it got
dare you?
banned. And I mean, I even read it in the United States, actually. I was on a vacation with my partner in Palm Springs because her parents book a cabin there, or they book up like an apartment there every winter. And we went to the Palm Springs library, and they had an amazing graphic novel section. And I just banned book club. I was like, I heard about this and it caught my eye. So I picked it up. I read that by the pool. And I was like, this is a really good book. And then I think probably like, I don't know, a month later, it was just like, this book is getting banned.
Yeah,
Yeah.
I really enjoyed Banned Book Club. I thought it was
Me
like
too.
Really compelling, and oh gosh, such an interesting perspective into a scary time in Korea and seeing it ripple back towards our culture and our shores here in the English-speaking world has been really scary. But having that record, I think, is incredibly valuable. And talk about producing a book in the right place at the right time.
Yeah, and the fact that it's like historical events and that there's a positive resolution at the end, that the dictatorship didn't last, like, I don't know, I find hope in that. That dictatorships don't, you don't know how long they're gonna last, but they won't last forever.
Yeah, that's really what I want to kind of get across, and what we were really trying to push with the No Rules Tonight is just like, guys, like, this has been done before. Like, you don't have to despair. Look at what was done. Look at how it was accomplished. Like, Korea's doing pretty good. And, there's still problems, but they figure out how to solve them.
Yeah, for sure. What book did we pick to talk about today?
Yeah, we should get talking about the actual book we're here
Well,
to.
we have talked about doing an episode on Banned Book Club. I think we probably will at some point. I think the last time it came up on our shortlist, it was out of print. It's now back in print, of course. So yeah, we're gonna do an episode one of these days for sure.
We have an accessibility rule. So we only feature episodes on the Trade Raider when we feel like our listeners can get the book. So that's what caused that delay.
It wasn't out of print. It was just stuck on a boat.
Oh, right.
That
That's
period.
right. Yeah,
It
it was
was a whole
like,
thing, but
right. Okay.
But the one we're talking about today, I wanted to talk about another banned book because, that's what I do now. I talk about banned books. And so I chose a banned book from also from the same publisher, Iron Circus Comics, As the Crow Flies by Mel Gilman. Yeah, so this book is about someone who feels very uncomfortable in nature. I want to know, what was the most uncomfortable all of you have felt in nature?
Oh, my name's Jeff Ellis, and when I was growing up, I was a Boy Scout, and I went to a lot of church camps, and so I've actually spent a lot of time out in the woods, and so this book actually resonated with me a lot for those reasons. And so generally, I have a pretty high threshold for discomfort in the wilderness. I think the worst experience I had was at a Boy Scout camp where we set up our tent, and then the junior boys who were inexperienced set up their tent. And then it was decided that because the tent we set up was bigger, the junior boys would use the tent we set up. So we used the tent that they put up, and they didn't put it up properly. And so it rained, and we basically had like water getting into our tent, and everything we had was soaked. And I mean, partly it was just that. It was a really rainy night, but it was also sort of set up on a hill, and like the guy wires weren't tight enough, and it was sagging. And anyways, that was probably the worst experience I had in nature. Just basically waking up to being flooded out of a tent.
Okay, I'm JD. I have run across bears a couple of times in the last few years, but that is not the most uncomfortable I've been in the wild. I love going for hikes in the woods, hiking up and down mountains, that's great. One time in a park in Abbotsford, I followed what I thought was a path. It was not a path, and then couldn't find my way back the same way I'd come. I decided, okay, this isn't a very big park. I'm just gonna like hike through and get to the other side. The entire park was filled with stinging nettles. And so I was like hiking through stinging nettles the whole way. And I mean, stinging nettles are uncomfortable at the best of times, but like that was a lot of stinging nettles. I ended up going to the emergency room after.
Oh
And they said,
no.
oh, yeah, no, you just gotta wait it out. There's nothing you can do.
Just be uncomfortable. Good luck with that.
So yeah,
Oh,
don't
that's
mess with stinging
awful.
nettles.
All right. Well, I'm Jam. I'm also a fairly outdoorsy person. I like hiking. I've been on multi-day treks, lots of climbing up mountains. And it's funny because, like, none of that time has made me feel uncomfortable because it's usually myself putting myself in that situation on purpose. And it's like you kind of come with a mindset of like, I'm going into nature to do this thing, and a certain amount of discomfort is part of the experience. And like there's an acceptance there. So what comes to mind is a time when I wasn't so voluntarily in nature. I used to go mountain biking a lot. And at one point, I was dragged on a mountain biking expedition while I was on vacation in Hawaii. And it rains a ton in Hawaii. And the day before we went on this particular trip, it had rained a ton and everything was just like complete mud. And it's like a type of mud where your bike just sinks into it immediately. So if you can imagine like a bike tire with an inch and a half of mud caking the entire wheel, and it just stops you immediately, right? And so you have to get off your bike, get the mud off your tires so it can roll again, and then go a little farther. And then this exact same thing happens. And so it was this Sisyphean expedition of just trying to get my damn bike through the damn mud so I could be done with mountain biking. And that was the most frustrating time that jumps to mind.
Yeah, for me, I once took a very ill-advised and poorly researched trip to the African wild, and my sister's a zoologist, so she invited me, and I'm like, I'll just show up. I don't need to research. I'll just show up, and I end up lost in the Masai Mara for an entire day, nearly eaten by lions, hanging out with hyenas. But that's not uncomfortable. That was actually great, and I loved every moment. The uncomfortable bit came shortly thereafter, where I had the moment that I thought only happened in movies, where you wake up and literally have no idea where you are or how you got there. And I woke up, I saw nothing but stars, and I felt really cold, and I realized I'm on the ground, and I'm like, where am I? Why am I wearing a winter jacket and no pants? And then suddenly I slowly realized that I had been climbing Mount Kilimanjaro. And I was so exhausted, dehydrated, and oxygen deprived that I'd blacked out. And then I felt really sticky, and I realized I had blacked out while pooping. And
Oh
I look up,
no.
and my guide is just sitting there, like looking at, like my sister, I call my sister, she'd given up hours before. It was just me and this guide. And he hadn't like woken me up or helped me or anything. He's just waiting for me to wake up, and he's like, "Just give up. I want to
Oh
go home."
no.
Oh,
Oh
like, you
man.
couldn't have been like, "Hey man, you just passed out while pooping. You need help getting up?" He's just like, "Just clean yourself off somehow. Can I go home?" Very uncomfortable the rest of the walk,
I
because
bet.
there was not a lot to clean myself up with.
Did you go to the rest of the way to the top, or did you turn
I did. I did. It took a long time, and he was very angry about
Oh,
it, but I got there.
wow. Wow. I should have known when you pitched the question, like, oh no, Ryan's gonna have like a much more exciting story than anyone else.
Mean, that makes me feel a lot better about my first two failed expeditions up Fuji. So, yeah, that's wow. That's something else.
All right. So, Ryan, do you want to tell us a little bit about Mel Gilman?
Yeah, so Mel Gilman is well known for an art style that just makes all cartoonists look bad. Like these very detailed colored pencil drawings with just amazing shading. I read on the website that Mel averages killing 1.5 colored pencils per page. So I can't imagine the amount of
Wow.
work that comes in all this detail. And just really famous for glorious, like, shots of nature and characters. And so, yeah, Mel studied comics at the MFA program at the California College of Arts. And As the Crow Flies was a webcomic originally, then published in a book. It won the Stonewall Honor Award, then went on to make the graphic novel Stage Dreams, and hopefully one day finishes up as the Crow Flies, so we can figure out what's up with this ceremony.
Oh, is there more to the story? I didn't know that.
Oh yeah, that's I didn't realize there was a part two. I thought it ended ambiguously for a reason.
Well, I mean, if you look at the webcomic, there's like 19 more pages that came out after the book, and it
Oh,
hasn't been updated in a
wow.
while, and I'm not sure what the plan is with it. I didn't want to, like, I was talking to Mel this morning, but I want to be like that guy and be like, so
Right.
when you finishing this?
That's so interesting. Because I mean, I've read this book. I think I read it when it first came out. I didn't know that it was a webcomic, or I think I've forgotten that it was a webcomic. And it's a great book. I love this book. And one of the things I like about it is the ambiguous ending. So I just assume that this was fully intentional.
Yeah, that's funny. I've read it several years ago, so this was my second time reading it as well. And yeah, I also thought that the ambiguous ending was intentional. It was funny because because I'd read it so many years ago, as we were talking about the ceremony, or as they were talking about the ceremony in the context of the book, I was like, wow, I've completely forgotten what the ceremony is. It's crazy. And then I get to the ending and I'm like, oh yeah, that's why. I remember now.
Yeah. Oh man, I'm really fascinated to know that there was like more available. I assume this was it. This is exciting because when I started reading this, I like couldn't stop. I stayed up way too late in the night because I had to get to the end, and yeah, I couldn't put it down. It was a really fun read.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of their art style. Like I'm not teaching any comics courses right now, but the last time I was teaching a comics course, I was teaching coloring was one of the main things I was doing. And so this book specifically was always one of the books I would bring out and say, "See, look, you can actually do a comic in pencil crayons. It is possible." Because I don't know of anyone else who's ever done that. And it's like it looks great. Like it's a great style. It's a great approach to using like materials that I wouldn't otherwise think about as being like quote unquote professional enough for comics, but this is proof that no, you can do this. It's possible. It's going to look good. And also, like I kind of take solace in this because I color all my comics with markers, and not very many people do that. Like Jam has done some. There's a few other people who have, but it's a really, really short list. So like I always say to myself, oh, okay, well I need to just be the Mel Gilman of markers. And be the one that's saying, like, no, look, it's possible. You can use markers on comics.
Yeah, about half of Wasted Talent was marker and the other half was watercolor. So it was with a few exceptions when various times I had broken my arms, it was made in a natural medium very intentionally, which I think definitely changes your relationship to the work when you're very intently working on something, creating it from blank page to its fully rendered, colored, realized state in a natural medium. But pencil crayon is still so unusual. You do see other watercolor works occasionally, which come with their own challenges. Usually, if you see a watercolor comic, it's limited to washes, like a gray or a single color, where you can cover a fairly large area in a relatively short period of time, and it has a very unique effect. Detailed watercolors are very unusual. Colored pencils, I've never seen anyone else do it. I've seen a few places in fandom that have used colored pencils as their medium, but what you mentioned earlier about it not being usually considered a professional medium, I think is also very, very interesting to think about. Because even in the fine art world, so it's interesting that Mel has an MFA, like in the fine art world, it's not one of the mediums that you see a lot of artists gravitating to. I think that's changing. I have been seeing more and more people making very detailed professional caliber illustrations out of colored pencil. But yeah, it's funny to take like an uncommon medium into comics, which also has this struggle, and somehow, like by putting the two together, it manages to elevate both, I think.
Yeah, and if you look at Mel's other work, like they do really interesting things with colors too. Like this is a single work, and so it's basically just essentially two colors. It's probably more than two pencil crayons, but it's basically two colors. And it's very consistent. Like it holds up really well. But like if you look at any of their other work, it's different colors. So every project is like a different limited palette, which is really interesting. Really good to see the variety that's possible.
I find that like most comics benefit from a limited color palette, regardless of medium, like whether it's digital or it's watercolor or it's pencil crayon, like marker, like a limited palette just seems to really benefit comics quite a bit. I've really been trying to shift myself away from the like full color everything, like really trying to think about a palette and just limit the color, because I think that that does really improve the work. But yeah, the pencil crayon, it's so unique. I mean, I think this is because I've been teaching a comic course that, like, when I saw the pencil crayon, it made me think of student work right away, because I've had so many students who will do pencil crayons, like, especially when I'm teaching, like, teenagers, because, like, they don't really have maybe the same know-how in Photoshop or access to, like, higher-end equipment. So they'll do, like, a comic colored in pencil crayon. And I actually wondered if this was maybe intentional to kind of evoke the age bracket that like people this age would be making comics with pencil crayons more likely than like an older person. Like, yeah, I wasn't, that was just sort of something that I mused about, but yeah, I've never seen a pencil crayon comic before, and I think it's really, really unique and really successful.
Yeah, I as I was just rereading it this week for the first time in a long time, I actually found myself really, really glad that my copy had gone missing for so long, because I just finished, illustrating No Rules Tonight, which is about characters climbing a group of kids climbing a mountain. And I'm like, if I had reread this while I was drawing it, I would just feel so bad about myself. Like, oh, I can't draw like that. Mine doesn't look like, oh, look at how like how those trees feel with every brush stroke, like meaning something and adding to it. Like I'm just like, oh God, that saved me so much self-esteem having this book go missing.
Yeah, I think
Just this
the
is like totally off topic again, but I was reading Banned Book Club and thinking the exact same thing about Phobos and Deimos. Like, oh, I mean, this is written by someone who's actually experienced living under a dictatorship. Like, this is what it would actually be like. My story, I saw it made up. I don't know what I'm writing about. So everyone gets that for somebody.
Yeah, I think going back to the pencil crayons, I think something that really stood out to me is how the medium brings out so much texture, and how that texture does feel very natural. Like the natural world is not smooth. There's no aspect of it that is smooth. And when you have the grit of the paper and the grit of the pencil crayon, I think it's just, it brings such a natural quality to it. And the other thing that I was noticing in the work was how skilled Mel is with layering. I think that's the other thing that really divides a beginner with pencil crayons with someone who is more experienced in using the medium to its full potential. So if you look at those tree sections, there's like multiple layers of coloring going on, and you can see some of it's almost like an underpainting shined through, and it creates such a dynamic effect, especially in the trees. And oh man, it was just so beautiful. Every page was stunning.
Oh yeah, like the saturation, like as things recede away, they're more desaturated because there's less pencil crayon on it, and then the things in the foreground get that extra couple layers of pencil crayon to just like intensify and bring them forward, right? The nature scenes were just so stunning, absolutely. I did have a little nitpick, which is like maybe this is because I've done a lot of hiking, but like I did not understand all the boots. Like I was like, why are they wearing cowboy boots? This is not how hiking boots work. I don't get it. I don't understand why the character has boots with three giant balls on the front of their shin. But
I
like
read it as
other than that, I really like.
symbolic. Yeah. I read it as symbolic. I picked up the same thing, and it's like laces are a major pain in the ass to draw, especially hiking boot laces.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
If you can think like pencil crayons, especially as a medium, like to get it to a very fine point, it's almost not what you want when you're trying to make a nice even wash for lack of a better term. Like you want a somewhat blunted tip to get that nice even layer down, And then if you have like a super sharp tip, which is what you need for those details, it like digs into the page and creates like an irreparable gouge that then like interrupts all the other things that you're doing. So I think it was a choice of being in harmony with the medium. Let's say trading some accuracy.
It could
Hadn't
also
thought about
be like
that.
a character design too, where like a lot of these kids are not used to being in nature, and maybe they're just it's sort of a way of visually showing that they're not really prepared.
It could be.
I
Yeah, I
mean,
think, yeah, like in my book, I had one kid wearing flip flops to make that point. Like, it might have been the point, but yeah, I was confused by the boots too, because like, when Charlie takes off the boots, suddenly the big circles are gone. So I'm like, what are those? What are they supposed to be?
yeah. I didn't understand the footwear, but like, I mean, like I say, that's a nitpick, but like that was the one thing. And again, maybe that's just 'cause like I'm intimately familiar with hiking boots, so I was just like, this is not how I would draw these. It was maybe just that was where I bounced off of it, but like
Yeah.
the nature stuff like more than made up for whatever strangeness in the man-made elements.
It does feel like a very specific like climate or environment. Like I haven't been to is it Colorado that it's set in?
I couldn't remember.
It was somewhere like southern Rocky Mountains. I've been to the northern Rocky Mountains, and it definitely has like it feels like it's definitely this is the Rocky Mountains.
Yeah.
Yeah, so what when you see all of those pencil strokes, like it just gives everything life, and that adds so much to the book, because the book does not in a bad like I'm it moves very slowly in a way that it's like letting you sit with each emotion. Like as soon when I'm looking at these pages, like I have a tendency to just put way too much dialogue, and every page is just all that. Like a character will say one thing, and you'll have the rest of the page is just characters thinking about what was just said, and you really feel something's going on in their head, like with the way it's they're rendered, the expressions, the strokes, like the way the background is drawn really helps you get into their head. And yeah, so I think that the combination of the art style and the writing style really fit together well.
Yeah, it's like
Yeah.
great. It's very deft cartooning for sure.
Oh yeah. I mean, so I was just flipping through as we're talking, and like the scene where B's telling the story by the campfire, and just the way that the flames of the fire have this glow, and I'm just like, that's just pencil crayon, right? Like, I mean, I work digital, so I'm so used to just, oh yeah, you just block in something, you apply a filter, you got a glow, but like, this is layers of pencil crayon to create this glow effect, and it's just kind of really impressive, just the artistry at work there.
Yeah, and so the other thing about the pacing that I loved is that what I like about this book is that there's no villain. It's not like these people are overly trying to make a hostile environment, but all the things they say, if it were just the way I write or the way a lot of people write, where it's just tossed off in one panel and then onto the next thing, we wouldn't necessarily notice them. But by having someone say something and then seeing the reactions, looking to other people's reactions, seeing they're not reacting the same way, all of this pacing really helps you feel why Charlie is feeling hurt by these little tiny comments and little things that make her feel like she doesn't belong.
Oh, yeah, like this was such a good book in just like illustrating microaggressions, I mean, again, I'm coming from a point where I don't experience a lot of microaggressions in my life, but just like reading this book, I was like, oh wow, like yeah, I can really see how you can sort of say a word that does you're not even thinking about it, but then it lands to someone else really. Really harshly, and I think this was a great way of kind of illustrating in a way like the difficulties of like really creating like an inclusive space. 'Cause I think if you were to ask B about this hike, B, oh, this is we're all women are welcome, we're all together, we're all united, but like there is this sort of undercurrent of hostility that's like making the two kind of main characters of the story feel really unwelcome, and there's this hostility, and like that's kind of the villain of the story, is this sort of this tension of the environment, the sort of like, it's not that you think B is a bad person, but just like the environment being fostered, you're like worried for the characters because they're in this situation where things could go wrong, right? There's the possibility of things going sideways.
Yeah, but also that environment is the whole world, because the origin culture is at its nature hostile in the same way because of the way that the society has been constructed. And I really like how this work functions as a little microcosm of it. One of my favorite scenes was early on in the work when Charlie encounters one of those microaggressions, and they immediately have this like record scratch moment where they're like, uh-oh. You know, here I am. I've detected a microaggression and I'm in a new group, and I need to now do this entire mental calculus of like, do I stand up and say something? Is this the point where I need to defend myself? How much, you know, negative ramification will I receive for not standing up versus standing up for myself and potentially like damaging my relationship with others versus the damage I will inflict on myself, or, you know, just accepting it and letting it roll on and maybe get worse. And meanwhile, the conversation is continuing. And Charlie is expected to
No.
sit there and continue listening to what is happening and potentially listening for more microaggression of like, is this going to get worse? And monitoring everybody else in the room. Like, I thought that was
Oh,
really
yeah.
beautifully illustrated as something that happens to many people quite frequently.
Well, I mean, the where Charlie got it wrong is what you got to do is you wait until you're just about to go to bed, and then you start playing through all the things you should have said and all the scenarios. You spend a good, like, 2, 3 hours at night tossing and turning, thinking all that over. And then, then you start afresh and have a new anxiety for the next day. That's how you live your life.
But Jeff, if the world is actually hostile to you, you have to do that stuff in real time.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
I think that the age of the characters fits with that theme super well, because like this is the kids in this story are an age where they aren't necessarily good at social interactions to start with. Like everyone's kind of like not really sure what they're doing, and so it's like those things I feel can hurt much more if you haven't been through them before, or if you don't have like a plan that you've gone through in your head beforehand of this is how I'm going to react in such and such situation. Like any group of kids, no matter how effectively you think you've set it up as like the leader of the group, the adult in the group, there is a tendency for kids to sort of flatten the culture between them, to sort of like prevent differences as a way of like, this is how we build our society. We're like working together. We all have to be the same. And I haven't necessarily experienced that from the inside, but I can see that from the outside of like, this has an impact on kids. Like this pressure is like very real and very powerful. And yeah, I enjoy reading a story that's from the point of view of a kid who's in this situation. I feel like that's important.
Oh yeah, definitely. I think it. Yeah, when you're saying jam, that it sort of speaks to our times. I think there was a lot wrapped up in this. Like, I thought it was interesting that this hike is sort of predicated on this legend of this famous historical figure. Like Beatrice wanted to hike, and the men wouldn't let her hike, and so then, this is all about feminism and women empowering themselves, and then sort of. Charlie and Sydney are both kind of starting to pick this apart and go like, well, this is really just something for privileged white women. This is actually a very exclusive endeavor. This is like not really empowering all women. And it sort of makes me think about at all the history podcasts I listen to where they're just like, oh, did you think this historical figure was like amazing? Well, like, let's actually talk about the realities of this historical figure. And yeah, I don't know. It felt very, yeah, prescient to like where we are right now in the culture.
Yeah, I do like that aspect where it does seem like we are in a unique time when we're starting to question some of these myths and legends. the story that we all grew up with of many of these people, we're given one version of it, but it was actually much more layered and nuanced from a social perspective. But even now, so there's a in the outdoors community, there's an actual or there's sorry, there's a the large conversation going on about this ongoing privilege and who has access to nature, who has access to the woods. And there's a lot of outdoorsy clubs and activities that many feel are not as inclusive as they need to be because of the compounding of this lack of access. You know, it's like, this is not a place that's safe for you. This is not a place that's welcome for you. This is not a place where you're expected. Things like camping, things like hiking, things like being able to just, you know, go off into the woods for 3 days and not have water. Like, different cultures have very different perspectives on that. It's like, why would you do that on purpose? And why would you go not have power on purpose? And it's very nuanced and layered. So I agree that like examining the historical aspect of it is really interesting, but it's something that continues to this day.
And what's so interesting is this book is about how there are these small parts of history that are the parts we don't talk about. And then, of course, once this book comes out, these book banning organizations are like I have the report right here from BookLooks talking about why this book might be an issue, and they just list every single line where someone mentions something mildly uncomfortable as a reason that you should be wary of it. And it's like that's yeah, but like there are things that are uncomfortable in life, and this is teaching children how, like, hey, maybe these are things we should talk about, or we should be aware of, or we should be aware of when we talk to other people it might affect, or know why it bothers us when people mention things. And it's just, yeah, it's there's a lot of people just trying to remove anything mildly uncomfortable from society.
Yeah, which I mean, this is just insane because, like, I mean, having just finished reading this, like, the idea that somebody was offended and thought that this needed to be banned, like, this is, I mean, yeah, there's some, I don't know, like, some challenging concepts in this book, but, like, I think this book is actually, you know, taking it pretty easy on the reader and taking it easy on everyone. Like, I've read works that are way more incendiary, way more confrontational with its audience. Like, I think this book is actually really trying to sugarcoat it and you know, hold you by the hand and very gently suggest some ideas to you. And I've had books that, you know, punch me in the face. And like, this book is very inoffensive. I can't believe someone would want this banned, you know?
Well, like I said, there's a list of every single line that might be an issue, and one of the very first ones is, in addition to being one of the area's first settlers, Beatrice is also its first feminist. So just making sure
What?
parents know that's in there. The word feminist, just in case that makes someone uncomfortable.
Oh, words have so much power. Like, as we've come into this moment in our culture where there's been more and more institutional and structural pushback on people challenging the way things are, let's say, like, it's really interesting how it has this effect of sanding off the edges of everything. So, yes, like, as you w look at this book, there isn't anything particularly sharp and incendiary in it, but it does have a lot of seeds of questions. And what's interesting about culture, and especially like children, as they form their view in the world, they can't get to something like, what does it mean to stand up against the patriarchy if they don't have that first seed of a thought that makes them go, well, wait a minute, I never actually thought about it that way. And sanding off all the seeds, you know, creating something super even, and so that there isn't anywhere where a thought like that can take hold, seems to be the goal of a lot of these people doing it. Like, I remember I was reading something that you posted, Ryan, about one of the objections to banned book club was like someone punching a cop, which is more incendiary, but like the way it was phrased was like, we don't want people to have the idea that you can challenge authority. Was kind of the way it was phrased, which I thought was even more shocking. Like, don't even think about that authority is something that can be challenged or questioned.
I mean, I find this even more upsetting because, like, I feel like these people that are wanting these books to be banned because, like, we don't want to tell people that they can, challenge authority are also probably the same people that were up in arms about, like, mask mandates and, like, quarantine, it's like, I don't know. I was just watching something and someone was talking about, people don't really like freedom. They like freedom for me, but they don't really like the actual broad concept of freedom. They don't actually care about it. They don't get behind it. They just like freedom for me, but like not actually all-encompassing freedom for all people. It's very frustrating.
Yeah, well, I mean, like, the what I've learned, like, in dealing with these book bans, and like, I've actually become pen pals with every person that's ever banned my book, and just to try and figure out what's in their heads. And what I've figured out is that, like, they're all of these people, like, there's this idea that it's large groups of parents that are upset, and it's absolutely not. It is very well-financed, well-organized people that these organizations are one person. Usually they don't live in the town, they don't have children in that school district, and they're funded by large organizations to go in and do that full time. And they don't believe in what they're saying. Like, they go on TV and say, oh, it's all pornography, but then I have access to their internal documents where they write their actual notes about what's in, and it where they think no one's looking, and the masks are off, and they're just like, oh, well, someone wore a pin in this that I didn't like in a background, or oh, this author said something somewhere I didn't like. I looked up in my big document this morning what they said about As the Crow Flies, and he had a two-word review, and it was just gender chaos. But like,
That'd be a
you were
great title for a
mentioning,
book.
Yeah,
you were
Gender Chaos
mentioning
is my
about
punk
the
band.
as a little side tangent, you were talking about people punching cops in my book. And so yeah, when our book was banned in one district in Florida, it was banned, like, the person that challenged it was one of the founders of Moms for Liberty. And so I messaged her on Facebook and said, hi, I'm the author, just wanted to know if you had any questions about the book. And she mentioned that she thought it was too anti-authoritarian because she thought it might offend the school resource officers in her school to have a book about p people punching cops. And I'm like, well, if I were a school resource officer at your school, I would be offended that you couldn't tell the difference between me and an actual military force that worked for a dictator to, like, murder children. And she's like, oh, okay, I didn't know it was real. Okay, I'll tell you what, I'll withdraw my complaint and
Oh
instead
my
make it
God.
required reading at every school. And I'm like, you still haven't read it, ma'am. Oh, you can't go wildly for what I weirdly have less respect for you now, because, like, you can't just go that wild a swing from no one should ever be allowed to read it to it should be required, and you still haven't read it. What are you doing?
Yeah, it's
Stand for
very
something.
like I can only imagine that, like, when your own work is targeted, it can feel incredibly personal. And what you seem to have revealed through your investigations is that it's shockingly arbitrary.
Yeah, none of I've checked everyone, none of them have read my book. And I asked about other books, like, oh, I haven't read it.
Oh.
So yeah, it's like I'm able to find it funny because it's not my story. I'm helping my wife tell her story. And so, like, that's why I do a lot of activism, because I know there are a lot of people that are telling stories so deeply personal to them that attack on the book is an attack on their identity and who they are. For me, I'm able to be like, y'all dumb. Like, what are you doing? This is silly. It's a book about banning books and you're trying to ban it. Come on.
There was I was talking to someone just like an hour ago online about book bans and how much it matters what the procedure is for challenging a book. Like the Ron DeSantis did this intentionally. He like rewrote the policy for challenging books in Florida to make it so that it's possible to produce a long list of books you want banned. You don't have to live there. You can be the other side of the country. Just like email it in, and then all those books have to be pulled off the shelves. Like that was a
And if they're
choice that
not, it's
was
a
made.
felony.
And that was a choice that was made to create the environment that we're in. And like let every school district, every library system has a procedure for challenging books. And the way that that procedure is written makes all the difference about what effect it has. Like where I work, Of course, there's a procedure for parents to challenge books, but you can't email something in from Florida and the book gets pulled off the shelf. Like that is not the procedure. And so like the it's so easy to rewrite these policies when nobody's looking and then create this like huge effect. And like clearly that was the plan.
Yeah, I'd like to bring it back to these ideas that are
Yeah.
so that many people find so incendiary, apparently. But something about like the idea of creating a women's space. So like it's so layered because you have this group that wants to honor the feminist movement of these pioneer women who wanted to rally together and form solidarity and do something that was considered unacceptable at the time. Like that is in itself a challenging idea. And then you have like the internal layer of Charlie and Sydney, who are both wrestling with, well, what does it mean to be a woman? What women's spaces, what is my relationship to women's spaces? And how much do I shrink myself to fit in? Or should I be trying to fit in? Should this space move to accommodate me? Or how should it change? Sydney is a trans girl. Charlie seems to have a difficult relationship with their own gender and they have a different race. And so all of these ideas at the same time are in tension and conflict. And I think it brings up so many interesting questions.
And it's interesting because like this like I don't know the background that sort of inspired this story, but I know that there are these sort of like feminist or pseudo-feminist movements within Christianity. Like my aunt wrote a book which I have not read because I'm not sure I trust her but like she's writing it from a very Christian perspective and supposedly the book is feminist, but it's definitely a thing that's real. Like, and this is themes like something like if you were serious about the Christian faith and you were very much like I want books written like that are pro-Christian or are considering Christianity seriously, like this, it feels like this is a book that is not in conflict with that. Like it's describing real things that happen. It doesn't necessarily directly attack Christianity. It, like, one of the things I like about the ambiguity of the ending right now is that you can either read it as Charlie is moving out of their faith and finding a different path, or Charlie is questioning but then coming back around. Like, I think that's a very effective way to tell that story where you're not actually like, because your reader is going to have a point of view one way or the other going in, and you're not going to change that reader's mind.
Yeah.
But you're creating this empathy of like, this is a experience that you may have felt or that people around you might have felt. And then you can just come up with your own conclusion at the end.
Yeah. And it's something that kids in particular at this age, many, many of them go through, I feel, especially when you're raised in a religious context and you start to get to that age where you are starting to form your own identity. You know, up until that point, you'd been kept in the bubble of everyone just tells you how it is and you just kind of accept it. But then as you understand more about who you are and your relationship to those ideas, it can be very scary and threatening. So something like Charlie and Sydney understanding their own identities and wanting to honor these ideas of God and faith and community that they'd been raised with, but seeing that it's so directly in conflict with fundamentally who they are. You know, it's like, where does your loyalty lie? What does it mean to stand up for yourself? I think those are some really interesting and important concepts.
And I think what's powerful about this book is that it's not about someone who has specific identity that's in conflict. It's about someone who's questioning, and is there room in this environment or in this world to question, whether it's questioning the way someone talks to you or how you feel about yourself? 'Cause like I noticed earlier when I was talking about the main character Charlie, like I bristled when I said the word she, because I'm like, wait, is that, even though the character says she all throughout, the book cover says she, but I'm like, this character feels like she's starting to question things and maybe coming to conclusions later, but like, you know, there's nothing in this character in this book that says what exactly Charlie is grappling with. And it's not like, here's the only non-Christian kid in a Christian camp, because Charlie's talking to God. Charlie's like thinking she's getting like thinking this feather was sent to her as a message. And but also you can see that that's like, am I being real weird doing this? Like, am I being silly? Like, it's all about, I have these questions, but I'm afraid if I'm in a space where I can ask them, even of myself.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I feel like these are like real questions, like serious questions that deserve to be thought about. And if you're banning the book that like takes the question seriously, you're basically telling people you're not allowed to have these questions. Something's wrong with you if you have these
Yeah.
questions.
Yeah, and I want to return to that concept of like a seed of an idea. So something that comes up quite often when it comes to gender fluidity, gender nonconformity, is that the authoritarian forces seem to want to ban any and all mention, identification of a concept of gender nonconformity, let's say. Let's just start with that. But Charlie is a perfect illustration of someone who will have those feelings, whether they have the words to explain them or not. And not having an explanation, not being able to say, like, oh, okay, this is a thing that happens to some people. And now I can evaluate whether or not that is also true for me because I have a basis of comparison and I have like a framework through which I can navigate it. In the absence of it, you just feel off, you just feel weird, and you just feel excluded and alone. And yeah, it's a scary place to exist.
Yeah, I just want to make sure. Well, we still have time here that I want to mention my favorite part of this book, which is like near the end. And like I'm gonna continue to read this book as like a complete work just because that's what we have to read, and I do really enjoy it this way. But there's that moment where B is telling the story of the founders of this, the pioneer woman, Beatrice. So she's telling the story of Beatrice like going out into the woods to do this like women's only retreat thing. And just in the telling of this story mentions this other woman who is going on the trip with her, who, and I want to quote this because I think it's like perfect the way it's described without B realizing what she's saying, that we don't know much about her, unfortunately. Her name was Chastity, and she was one of the few unmarried women in town. She was Beatrice's most beloved companion, her dear Nug. They were as close as two women could be, practically sisters. And Charlie immediately clocks, like, oh, this is not the story I thought it was at all. And
Historical
just such a,
roommates.
yeah, it because it's so perfect
Just
because it's like,
real close.
it's like, she like Charlie and Sydney are not alone. People like them have existed and been on this exact same journey, literally on the same path forever. And it's just such it feels like an answer to a question, but not spelled out in words. And I think that's such a powerful moment in the
Yeah.
story.
And another subtle thing, if we're talking about like the very subtle ways you can tell a story, there's another story buried even within that, where the fact that the person telling the story about Beatrice is named B.
Oh,
So it's a
right.
very subtle thing that like this story means more to her than you might think immediately. Like there is history there. Maybe she's named after this person. And if you were to question this story and be like, hey, maybe those two were she would maybe not take that well.
Right.
Especially
Yeah.
given, and I didn't notice this the first time I read the book, however many years ago, because all the microaggressions against Charlie are like, Charlie has a reaction to them, and so you notice them as a reader for sure. But the first time I read this book, I didn't notice how often B talks about quote unquote men invading women's spaces and how that specific comment might be interpreted by Sydney.
I
Oh,
had the
yeah.
same experience because the reveal of Sydney's transness isn't until very much later in the book. And it is really interesting reading it a second time and trying to weave through her perspective as well.
Yeah, it's just
Yeah.
so deftly done because as a reader, you may or may not notice this because the story is not from Sydney's point of view. So it's from Charlie's point of view, and I assume I'm going to assume as the reader that Charlie isn't noticing this, but that Sydney might well have noticed it the whole time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, very early in the story, when you first meet Sydney, Charlie comments on the fact that Sydney has bear spray and says, like, "Oh, I don't think there's bears on this trail." And Sydney sort of says, "Well, you might need bear spray for other reasons." And I was kind of like, "Is Sydney trans?" And then later on in the book, I was like, "Oh, okay, yeah, like that's what that comment was about." Like, which is, I mean, and that's also kind of depressing, this idea that this girl feels like she has to carry bear spray on this hike in case she gets outed, like which a lot of again, a lot of the men invading women's spaces, and this is a women's space, this is a women's only event, is something that B repeats over and over and over again. I think that really ramps up the tension. At least it ramped up the tension for me reading Sydney's part of the story. I'm like, oh man, like if B finds out, this is going to be a thing. This is going to be a problem potentially. And I mean, again, this is where like it's like a cliffhanger at the end, because you're like, well, I don't know. We don't know. We don't know if anything gets found out,
But this is what I like about the ending as it stands, is that it feels like the important question has been answered. Like there are a lot of questions brought up in this book. We don't know what the ceremony is. We don't know what's going to happen with these characters after. But the thing that we do know for sure is that Charlie and Sydney have found each other, that they found community, at least among the two of them, and also that they found community with the founder of this movement. Like that sort of triangle of like support within this structure, like it almost doesn't matter what the rest of the structure is like after that.
That's good observation. I like that. Yeah, this is I really liked sort of the all the character moments that came up in this sort of whole story of this sort of hike, which I've never been on a hike this intense, which I will say, I mean, this is, sorry, I don't want to derail this too much, but like just the my inner Boy Scout was really, really upset with how B didn't pack enough painkillers and like didn't seem to be prepared for all these like contingencies. I'm like, what are you doing? You're taking all these teenagers up a mountain and like you aren't like prepared? Like, what is going on? How many years have you been doing this?
And then acting like it's their fault for needing the supplies.
Blaming the kids, I did not like, but I think I just read into it like B's anxious nature. It's like, oh man, I only packed 3 bottles of painkillers and I've already given out three. What if there's like a meteor that strikes and I need to give every single kid another painkiller?
I hadn't read it that way. Okay, maybe, yeah, maybe it's more being hyperbolic. I read it as being honest, like, oh, I didn't actually pack enough painkiller. I'm like, what? Who planned this? Come on.
I think, Jeff, you're reading it the same way that Charlie is reading it. Like, it's like that she's being blamed for this. And whether or not that's actually B's intent, like, that's how that's going to be interpreted.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and
And
it's
like,
really powerful showing B as the like I said, I love that B is not treated like a villain. Like that line that is so scary when she says, you know, oh, I thought you were going to say you were a man or a devil worshiper, a man. Like that's something that in B's mind she's saying, like, oh, I thought you were going to say you were an alien, because it's so foreign a concept to her that she thinks it's silly, a silly thing to say, and she's trying to be funny and cute. But it's not, and it's showing, it's really showing the power of words in a way that you can hurt someone even if you're trying to, you know, lighten things up.
yeah, and it is also a really interesting way to write on a quote unquote antagonist for a work. I think it shows really plainly that when you're trying to do something subversive, like existing as you authentically are, your enemies aren't always the demons you might imagine. They are the keepers of the status quo. And those people aren't trying to necessarily push back against you, but by keeping things the way they are, they do create a force that's hostile to you.
Yeah, B very well might have the like in this house we sign in her front yard, like, and thinks that she's like so welcoming to everyone.
Well, I mean, she's the one who's like running a feminist organization within a Christian group. So I think you're probably right.
I mean, I think this is one of the things that I really appreciated about this work, though, is that it sort of addresses the fact that it's a lot of this stuff comes out of good intention. I think this is the thing I've been reflecting on a lot in our current moment, our current climate, is like I think we spent a lot of time vilifying the people that weren't aligning with our politics or our vision of how we think the world should be, and just screaming at people and calling people names isn't really changing anybody's mind. And I think it's a much harder path to walk, but I think that like recognizing that everybody's approaching life from their perspective, and most people are this I'm some my partner passed this off to me, and I think this is from like Brené Brown or something, but it's like everybody's trying their best with the tools that they have access to. And it, I don't know, I'm really trying to apply this in my interactions with people. It's like sometimes people have bad opinions and bad politics, but it's like I have to sort of recognize like, well, they come from a background, they come from a situation that set them up this way, and they're seeing the world this way, and they have these concerns. And if I really want to try to change their mind, we have to kind of meet somewhere where we're not just, mad at each other. And, it's like, I mean, potentially B is going to have conflict with Sydney, but it's like, it's kind of this recognition that like B is telling herself, like, I'm setting up this woman-only space. I'm this feminist pioneer. I'm like protecting women and making the safe space for women. And like, that could very well lead to like her doing a bunch of turfy stuff and being really bad later. Who knows? I don't have to read book two, but like, I think it's like this recognition. It's like, it's really tough. It's a tough thing to reckon with that, like, the easy way would be to write B as a terrible person, that B is awful, B is the villain, but like B is just a person and B has a perspective, and it comes into conflict with our characters. And I don't know what the solution is, but like I think that that's sort of illustrated really well in this book, is that like nobody's a mustache twirling villain. It's like everybody's got their perspective,
Yeah, I think you said something important there that I just want to echo and reiterate, that everyone is trying their best to make what they feel is a better world. And we can achieve a lot by remembering that and bringing us all back to this idea that it's like we all want things to be better, but we have different perspectives on what better looks like and what the current moment looks like now.
I mean, I struggle with this a lot, like coming out of 2020, like I was just coming into conflict with people that were like anti-mask and anti-vaccine. And it's like, I mean, it makes sense, but then on another level, it's like I'm not changing anybody's mind that way. And so then I have to sort of say, okay, well, like you're scared. You're worried that this shot is gonna, I don't know, mutate you or something. I don't know. You got these concerns. And like, I could laugh at that and I could say, oh, you're dumb and you don't understand science, but like, that's not bringing them on my side. So then it's like, how do I kind of be like, hey, I know you're scared. Let's talk about what you're scared of. Like, how can we make you not be scared? Like, let's work on this, and that's, I mean, that's a lot of work. And I understand why a lot of people are just like, I don't have the time to do that work. And so it's just easier to block people and write them off. But like, sorry, that was maybe too
Oh,
much.
we're gonna run out of time here. Any other thoughts about this book?
I really like this book. I think
Yeah.
it's really beautiful and it says a lot of interesting things. I think it's a beautiful capsule. It's so limited in scope and yet manages to say so much. And it deserves to be widely read and preserved. And I could recommend it to almost anyone.
Yeah, this is, I mean, yeah, this is a book for all ages, all types. It's got a little something for everyone, and I still can't believe this is a banned book. Like, it's just like this book should just be on all the library shelves. Yeah, it's a great book.
I'm now
Yeah, it's a...
realizing I don't have this book on my library shelf. Maybe I
Oh.
should.
Yeah, I think it's a very specific type of storytelling that makes you feel like you're there. It doesn't feel like you're being told a story. It makes you feel like you're along on this trip and kind of getting into the heads of characters in it. And so yeah, I'm glad, very glad that it exists, and I'm very frustrated that some people don't want it to.
You know
Yeah.
what they say, if you don't like a book, don't read it. You don't have to read any of the books in the library.
Yeah,
I'm the one running the library, and I'm not making anyone read
I
any books. You pick your own book.
mean, this is that applies to so many things, you know? It's like you don't have to watch that movie, you don't have to read that book, you don't have to watch that TV show. You don't have to reply to that post you just saw.
I don't have a book to shout out.
I don't have a book, but I have a TV show to shout out. It's a relatively recent, like 2017, I think, TV show. I was on Netflix and I just wanted something dumb, to be honest with you. I just wanted something dumb and in English that I could put on in the background. And I stumbled across this story that ended up being quite captivating. It's called Travelers. And it's a low budget science fiction. It's shot in Vancouver. It's shot exactly like a cop procedural, but it's about a group of people from the future who have been sent back in time, take over the consciousness of people who are, you know, going to die. So for one reason or another, someone is going to die. And then the moment before their death, we don't know, just puts a consciousness into that. And now they're an agent from the future and they're trying to change the future. And it's like I said, it's very low budget. So we see almost nothing of like high tech stuff and the future. And we only learn about it through acting and dialogue. And I think you in particular, JD, would enjoy this show. It ended up being really compelling. And I think it's a sleeper, but I've never heard of it. It's
I
great. I think I tried watching that and I didn't get very far, but maybe I should try again.
Oh, it goes places. It goes
Okay,
places.
okay. Like Netflix was recommending it had a, because it is all algorithmically generated. One of the topics it had on my feed was time travel stories. I'm like,
Yeah,
okay, that was for me.
oh, they
And
got
this
your
is
number.
exactly it. And I know why you dropped off because, like I said, it is shot exactly like a cop procedural. That's
But
it. Yeah, I'll try it
it
again.
does, yeah. And it's shot in Vancouver, which is also fun.
I remember somebody recommending that show to me too. So I have heard good things about that. I'm going to recommend an independent Canadian film that I watched during VIFF, just because like who's watching independent Canadian film? You guys should go try and find this. So it's called Can I Get a Witness? It's by Anne Marie Fleming, who's the writer and director, and the most prominent actress in it is Sandra Oh, who you probably know from Grey's Anatomy. And it's a science fiction movie that is set in a world that is recovering from climate change. And it's sort of utopic and dystopic kind of at the same time, because it's sort of it's a world that has recovered from a climate catastrophe, but the way in which they have recovered involves like people having to voluntarily commit suicide at age 50. And it's about these people who are witnesses, and they bear witness to people doing their duty as a citizen and keeping the population low. And I mean, it's, I think, very much, I think I read it as proposing a world to people saying, if we don't start making changes now, this is where we're going to end up, was kind of how I read it.
All right, I have finally started reading books again. I finally have time. I recently read Witchlight by Jesse Zabarsky. It's a fantasy story. There's these two women who kind of get thrown together. One of them is a witch. One of them is basically a sword fighter, although I don't think that's how she thinks of herself. And they're just sort of journey through the countryside, gradually like growing closer together. And yeah, it's not like a deep story, but it's a very well told story.
I'm going to recommend a book that I've talked about a lot lately, just because it's the book that really, when I tell people about what happened with it, is one that radicalizes them against the current book bans. There's a book called Zen Shorts. It is a children's book about kindness illustrated with cartoon bears. In one of the stories, a very kind bear is very poor, lives alone. A raccoon breaks into his house to rob him and realizes he has nothing to steal, and the bear says, "Oh, you must be cold. Please take my jacket." This book was banned at the same time as Banned Book Club because they said that its story of radical empathy is incompatible with Christianity, and that it should have
Sorry,
instead
what?
taught the castle doctrine so that children know that they're allowed to shoot the raccoon. Again, on TV, they're putting pornography in schools. Behind doors, they're like, This story is teaching people to be nice. We want to teach them to shoot. So yeah. And then if you want a more recent book about cartoon bears, I recommend The Inscrutable Dr. Bear and the Case of the Two-Face Statue by Jerzy Drozd.
I do have Zen Shorts in my library. I haven't read it, but now I want to.
Oh
Oh
man. And I
man. I
before we
don't
close off, I just wanted to thank you again, Ryan, for the work that you've been doing, both in telling bringing some of these stories from other cultures and how they have resisted authoritarianism to the Western culture, and the very direct work you're doing to support people whose books have been banned and trying to protect libraries and the books that we all love. So thank you so much, Ryan. I think it's really important.
Thank
Thank
you.
you. It's wild just like having learned about like librarians in America literally risking being fired or going to jail to keep my book on the shelf. I'm like, I will do whatever I can to help you. Like you're doing far more than like librarians are doing far more than I am. I'm sitting cozy in my house in South Korea. They're on the line.
Yeah, I mean, who would have
Why it's
thought?
important for schools to have libraries. Not every school has a library. Every school in BC does, or nearly every school, but that's not true everywhere. I feel like places that don't have school librarians, you have set it up. Again, you're setting up a system that's built to fail. Books are going to get removed from that library because there's no one watching it.
And in return, I want to thank you guys for what you do. I know that long ago you mentioned earlier you did a episode about my comic Broken Telephone, and a lot of the things you said, I'm like, yeah, I agree with that. I agree with that. And then just this year, I put out a anniversary edition of the book and edited it to fix all of the things you guys said were confusing. So,
Oh,
hey,
wow.
you're making books better.
Oh, man. Oh, that's so heartening. Wow, I think that was one of our first episodes
It
too.
was really early on,
It was pretty early.
So Ryan, where can people find you on the internet if indeed you want people to find you on the internet?
Yeah, find me. Go to ryanestrada.com. Any social media you want is linked there. There are thousands of pages of free comics there, and there's information about Banned Book Club, No Rules Tonight, Occulted, my Student Ambassador series, all sorts of things that that you can check out either in bookstores, in libraries, or right there on the site.
Awesome. Okay, our next book is going to be O Human Star by Blue Delaquanti.
The Trade Waiters is presented by Cloudscape Comics. We'd like to thank Sleuth for the music. You can find us wherever you find your favorite podcasts.